All right, you guys should be seeing this going live any second now. We're coming on to the conclusion. It's been a wild ride, hasn't it? We got through Dr. Glover. We're getting through Dr. Smith. What's up next? Who's to say? Who won the free book? I don't have the answer for that one yet, but I'm getting to it. But we're going to get to the important part here. You're going to love the thumbnail for this one because chicks on thumbnails sell, and we're talking about intimate relationships, so I threw one on there. Look at that jawline. You can tell she mews in her spare time, doesn't she, boys? I'm just messing with you. Thanks, guys. I know we're on a couple minutes behind schedule. Welcome to the Sidebar Series. When I say no, I feel guilty. Parts 10 and 11. Intimate relationships, the finality of it all. Let's pause this one up here. Hey, future MD, shout out to Ryan for CP time. I finally made it before the middle of the cast. Love you, bro. Looking forward to it. Awesome. I tried to stall as long as I could to get you down here, but the guys were getting restless, so here we are. That's really bright. Let's see if we can turn this down a touch and just get some... There we go. Some normal levels of light. I don't want to look like this is set up to be a 40-year-old's Tinder account here. You can whitewash the whole thing. This is kind of an interesting set of chapters because it lets you know how dated the material is and how it differs from what you would consider like red pill canon, I guess, because being that this was written and came out in the 70s, it's still kind of having that attitude of equality in relationships and relational equity and communication being the best guide. So there's going to be a couple deviations from stuff that the book is suggesting and stuff that we found in the field that tends to work in the modern day. So when those come up, we'll talk about those and we'll discuss them. As usual, I skip most of the dialogues because they're not very applicable, but there was one in here I kind of wouldn't mind talking about a little later because it seems to have a bit more of a timeless quality to it. I'm going to make an effort now to keep an eye on the chat while we're talking. Normally, I'm so busy staying in the groove here, getting everything going, that I don't pay enough attention to what you guys are chilling and talking about. Hello from Croatia. All right, so let's get to it. What is this? What is the point of learning fogging, negative inquiry and negative assertions? What's the point of broken record? We've already learned how to use that at work. We've learned how to use that when approaching people. How about when it comes to sex? Because that's what everybody cares about in the end. Nobody needs to worry about it in a hugging relationship. As Dr. Smith puts it, the most difficult situations in which to learn to be assertive are those involving people we truly care about, our equals, like friends, partners, lovers, and mates. An equal relationship has at least an a priori structure of any of the interactions you can have with another person. When conflict on an equal arises, you ask, how should you cope with it? Just suppose that your roommate is gay, and only after you learn of it, he or she puts that make on you. What should you do? I'm not sure what he meant by that. I guess, yeah, it's the 70s, whatever. There's a book of rules to tell you how to relate to gay friends properly. Does Emily Post know? In an even less threatening example, what do you do if your roommate wants you to date a friend of hers or his, and you just can't work up any enthusiasm for the idea? More commonly, what rules do you follow? What do your friends and roommates keep bugging you about particular actions? The gist of it is, now we've talked about the spectrum of human interaction based on its formality. Obviously, commercial ones are the most. Contracts, employers, employees, sometimes it's subject matter experts. You're going to get a very structured set of rules to follow, and then guys are very good at that. As long as you stay within the rules, like the policy says this, I stick to the policy and I'll be all right. That's easy. Assertiveness on there tends to be just adhering to the rules and getting the other people to adhere to them. The second one is an authoritative set, and that's, you know, cops and people they pull over, that's parents and children. There's an authority there, an ultimate authority and a hard power that you just don't have in the engagement, but it's more nebulous. The rules aren't so certain, so the other person does tend to lean on authority more. Now, from a parenting perspective, if they tend to lean on that too much without creating a set of rules, more like a commercial hierarchy, you're going to get kids who end up becoming nice guys. And so that's the thing of it there. But at the same time, you realize the importance of soft power and the lack of hard power in situations. So you can be persuasive, but at the end of the day, the other person has the ability to veto any type of authority you do. How do you still assert your assertiveness? And that's where you have your tactical assertiveness or tactical alpha characteristics. That's what we've talked about before. This one is specifically about that nebulous zone of relationships. There is no rule book on how to date. There's no rule book on sex. There's no rule book on this. And anytime you're getting rules about dating and relationships, it's somebody covering up their insecurity by trying to control the situation. And that's usually where manipulation comes in. So the first part of this is understanding the nature of the arrangement. It's not a rigid hierarchy. There's no rules. It's people make it up as they go. It's a giant game of Calvin ball. That's Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin would play with his little pet tiger and he'd always make up the rules as he went to benefit him. So you realize that people are using those for that purpose. And No More Mr. Nice Guy covers it quite well. Here we mostly get to the assertiveness part where you identify when somebody is doing this based on their certain insecurities and then use your tools in a non-escalatory way to assert your boundaries without having the other person escalate this to, you know, emotional or physical conflict. It's kind of a neat little superpower. And then use that until you're able to naturally assert your boundaries, naturally have a strong frame, and see through these manipulative attempts to control situations and address the core issues. And that's the idea of being the oak, which we've talked about in depth on this series. Being the oak, the value that you add to relationships and the obligation you have to offer it to nobody unless they deserve it. So yeah, again, these tools are not for plates. These are relationship tools. These are people that you plan on seeing again. These are people that have earned a place in your life. They've generally shown value, and now you got to deal with all the other BS, because as much as we hate to say it, women have a pretty rough go of things too. Guys have a very rough go and nobody cares. Girls have a rough go of it and everybody cares, but I have a great video where I make a Japanese omelet sandwich. Girls are lied to their whole lives, so it kind of lets you lead the ones that put some effort into the relationship. So we're going to skip a lot more of this one. And here's something else. So here's an additional part onto it. So there's going to be a lot of older people on this channel. I've checked the demographics. I think 20% of you guys are over 45, so it's awesome. I didn't know people that old were on YouTube still, but I'm glad you're here. Older patients that I have seen in conflict with their adult children often have hidden anxiety agendas about being left alone or financially dependent, especially if their own spouse is physically disabled or has passed away. So again, these same tools work very well with family. And this is parents that are getting older and worried that their kids won't help them take care of them when they get sick and old. Parents who still control kids even after they've moved out, very common. In fact, I've found a lot of the Southeast Asian immigrant community has huge problems with controlling parents, basically setting the kids up for failure. So he talks about these hidden anxiety agendas which can sometimes be coped with by the patient with the help of assertive, emotionally supportive adults like the patient's adult offspring. But the hidden anxiety agendas, unfortunately, are expressed by the most demanding and rigid but kind manipulation of children by early parents. So that's kind of the interesting thing. The parents are the ones that taught the kids these manipulative tricks. Go back to No More Mr. Nice Guy where I talk about the transactional analysis of it. So parents will talk to their children like, you're a bad boy. Bad boys don't do this. Good boys do this. Children are generally insecure about their safety. So what they do is they do what they have to do to keep that identity of good boy because they have a fear of abandonment when they're helpless as children. Now, because there's a lack of male influence as the kids grow up, this never kind of goes away. In fact, the female teachers reinforce it all the way up to, in this case, like sometimes young adults, sometimes even later. A guy can make it 18 years without a single male influence on his life. That's not, and it's a very lazy parenting and teaching strategy to attack identity like this and tap into those fears of abandonment. So a lot of these assertive tools are really about hardwiring or changing the hardwiring of the mental models you learned when you were a child and have reinforced for the last, 18, 19, 20, 30 years of your life. Again, the irony of it is that as parents get older and they kind of have a more helpless position, the kids adopt the exact same style. I talk about the parent, adult, and child models of the transaction analysis. So when kids start to have this manipulative way of basically tapping into the parents' old age fear of abandonment, they're adopting the parent model and the adults are adopting the former parents were adopting the child model as opposed to the adult model, which again is generally positive assertiveness, rational self-egoism, the kind of stuff that we would equate with being red-pilled. So because of the possibility of hidden anxiety agendas operating with close relationships, I suggest to learners that they be assertive with empathy when dealing with the people they care for with the emphasis on being assertive. This makes reference to something we call the benevolent dictator. I've talked before, Ian Ironwood in the Praxeology of the Dominant Male. I'll put that one in the chat here too. So Praxeology of the Dominant Male. Where's the chat? Oh, there she is. Give it a read when you get a sec. But you'll see here he talks about male-dominated relationships, and the idea of being in a male-dominant relationship is that of like a benevolent dictator. You are the final say, you're the captain of the ship, you're the one who's ultimately the dominant figure in the relationship, taking the lead, the leadership, the oak, all the stuff we talk about here. But you do it with a benevolence. Like, you're not there just to control other people and, you know, be a tyrant. It's a benevolent dictator. If you've been watching politics on the news for the last election year for the states, and I don't know why you have, but if you have, you'll kind of notice that a lot of the push from the female side of demographics down there are pushing for this exact kind of arrangement with their political figures. Whether that's related, I don't know. I just found the parallels kind of interesting. So he goes through some examples in here. I'm going to skip a lot of them, and there's a lot of examples here. Like opening up to a neighbor who wants to cut down the gum trees. Asking a good friend for a business loan. And by the way, don't ask a friend for money and don't loan money to a friend. If you give it, it's a gift, or you don't do it at all, because that'll ruin your relationship. But the one I like here, because this is going to, anybody in a relationship will kind of relate to this. It's dialogue 28. Sandy gradually changes the relationship between herself and her parents from an authoritarian one to an interaction between equals. Everybody here, anybody who's got a girlfriend or a wife in the chat, throw some ones in the chat if she has arguments all the time with her mother. Some kind of adversarial relationship with her mother. Twos if you don't see it and they're actually perfectly friendly together. I'd like to see this one. I'm betting it's a lot of ones or it's a bunch of single guys, but that's fine. He goes on to say, in all my assertive classes and therapy groups, more than half the learners have failed to establish an equity relationship between themselves and their parents. They live away from mom and dad, sometimes for many years, yet their parents still keep the mantle of ultimate authority over their children. In most cases, these parents do not tell their children what to do, but somehow reserve the ultimate approval or disapproval of their now adult offspring. Look at that. One's already popping up. Passive-aggressive, one-sided. And that's the thing. If you hear it from the wife's mouth, she's going to say that, you know, mom is passive-aggressive and evil. Your dad-in-law is talking to the mom, and she's, like, saying the same thing back. And really, all it is two parties have a horrible ability to set boundaries and a power struggle between them. There's actually been a fair amount of field reports from guys who have, this is their initial problem, is that they went from their wife adopting the parent model and them adopting the child model to getting married to doing the same thing with their wife. And then the conflict comes when the wife and the mother interact, because they're both basically fighting over who gets to have their son simp over them, who gets to have the guy simping. And right there, guys have a hard time with this because they're afraid of conflict and they're afraid of being assertive. These two women will have a huge fight over extended periods of time over the heart of their boy. Meanwhile, if he just takes the lead on both of them, acts assertively, shuts this stuff down, not only do you end up having it where you're not having two women who probably both aren't sleeping with you fighting over your validation, but you're actually going to make their lives a bit better, and your father-in-law, who clearly isn't able to shut this down on his end, will most likely thank you as well. So in the example they go here, Sandy is learning to assert herself in interactions with her parents to stop doing the fights. I don't know how applicable this is, because I find most girls kind of like the fighting. Like, they prefer to fight with their parents. It gives that emotional high to them, especially if they have very drama-free lives. And if you're a good man, you probably should have one. So I'm not saying you should encourage your girl to do this. She has to want to do it. Don't try and red pill your wife. She won't care. You just lead by example. Make sure you're not adding to the problem. And if she wants to pick fights with her mom or her mother-in-law all the time to get that out of her system, then that's fine. Just set some strong boundaries for yourself. A good one we have is we set a time limit on the complaining and the bitching. So, for example, in my life, my girl and I were both working downtown, so we'd walk to work. It's like a 30-40 minute walk. And we had the time from when we met up at my office, which was closer to our house, from that time until we walked through the door, if she wants to bitch about her mom or a coworker or whatever, that's your time. Once we walk through this door, no more. And by putting a structure on it like that, by establishing a boundary, and that was the boundary I liked. It could have been anything. Set up 5 minutes, phone call at lunch, whatever you want to use. You give it enough structure that people end up being confident inside of your frame. And that gives them the structure that they need to live much better lives. Because, like I said, benevolent dictator. People love having the strongest person in the room tell them what to do. It allows them to ignore their insecurities. It allows them to enjoy their time without worries about rejection or abandonment. It's like, there's your Calvin Ball rules. As long as you stick to them, even if you lose the game, you're playing the game and it's always going to be there. Thank God for that. So in this case, because of her anxiety and dealing with her mom, Sandy requires a lot of practice before she began to change her style of responding to her parents' manipulation of her behavior. As things turned out, when she began asserting herself towards mom and dad, Sandy went through a half dozen assertive encounters similar to the early parts of this dialogue before she noticed her change in mom's behavior and attitude. I won't read the examples here. Like I said, read the book. You'll find them yourself. I'll just tell you the story about my dog. I've mentioned it before. Hitchens. He's the biggest of the Italian Greyhounds. He's actually a monster. He's almost 20 pounds. And what he'll do is he can reach on my counters. So my kitchen counters, if there's anything within the first 4 inches of the counter, he can jump up and grab it and swipe it off, throw it on the floor. Stole a loaf of bread once. So now every chance he gets and every time we're not watching him, he'll go over there and try and look for something at the top of the counters. I'll go to the bathroom. I'll come back. I'll see him in the kitchen trying to do it. I'll scoot him out of there. So he'll try that 100 times, not get anything. But there's always that one time where the girl and I forget and he does it all over again. So we literally have to be 100% on the ball for an extended period of time to train that out of him. And unfortunately, we're human beings, so we're not perfect. So what does this story have to do with assertiveness training with the girl and her mom? It's that you spent years with these horrible non-assertive behaviors. You start asserting them for 1 week, you can't expect everything to turn around overnight. People, I've always been talking about neuroplasticity or the ability of the brain to absorb new information. Brains in general are plastic. They don't change. Once they've got something set and it works, they just stick with it. They put it on autopilot and you don't even think about it. That's why instinct works the way it does. It takes less cognitive energy. It takes less calories to run. And in general, it's a good survival trait. However, when it comes to these mental models, these non-assertive mental models, these manipulative mental models, once you start pushing against the grain, it attacks people's ego or their intrinsic mental models. And so what they do is they don't change to adapt to the new way of doing things. They double down on it and they get worse. Another example, like the dog. If you've ever seen a single mom in like a toy store with the kid and the kid starts screaming, and then the mom sits there trying to beg with him, trying to plead with him, trying to reason with him. And he keeps screaming and throwing stuff on the floor. And then he buys her a candy bar and the kid shuts up. That kid knows that if he just screams that little bit louder and that little bit longer, mom will acquiesce to him. So you literally, and so it's not just kids, it's adults, it's everybody. It's your girlfriend, it's your wife. If she nags you and she finds that 5 minutes of nagging gets what she wants out of you, well then the first time you try to put up with her nagging with some assertive stuff, she's going to nag for 6 minutes and then 7 minutes. So it gets worse before it gets better. And you really need to articulate this to people who start acting assertively. The same way you have to articulate to a guy who just started working out. I've been working out a month. Why am I not jacked? It's like, dude, it took you years to be this couch potato. It's going to take a while to get out of it. And so the married red pill thing is you suggest 1 month for every year that you've been a schlub in your relationship. It's a rule of thumb. Sometimes it's faster, sometimes it's quicker, but it sets guys' sights on a long-term horizon of this. So the point is consistency. The point's not winning your wife back. The point is learning these skills, building up your alpha characteristics, becoming more attractive, becoming less unattractive. That's a lot more ones than I thought it was going to be. Not going to lie, guys. But yeah, and this guy here, my wife and mother get along just fine. Oh, no, wait, it's her mother that sucks. Yeah, that's the thing. And it's not just a female to parent thing, too. It's also a male thing. I've noticed, like I said, Southeast Asia tends to have it the worst for a lot of those kids. But in this case, it's this guy, Paul. And his parents very much wanted for Paul to do things their way and for Paul to be the kind of son that they wanted him to be. This is that helicopter parent, hockey dad, yelling at the coach, living vicariously through their children stuff. That's all too common now for kids nowadays who have now become adults. And now you're here watching me ramble on about hypergamy. So all this meddling in Paul's affairs was done in an altruistic family way, with the end result that Paul was quite dependent on his parents, even after he became an adult in the chronological and legal sense. Twice during his 10 years of marriage to Connie, Paul had separated from her. Both times, Dad intervened and talked Paul into taking her back, even though Paul said he was utterly miserable living with her. Paul and Connie never had any significant marital battles, even though there was a lot of conflict over them, over money, religion, the raising of the kids, how Paul should spend his relaxation time for himself, or doing things that Connie wanted him to do. So Connie's style of controlling Paul was to cut him up manipulatively without getting angry, and Paul responded to Connie in the same way that he dealt with his parents. He quietly argued back, did not cut Connie up verbally the way she did him, but gave in most of the time. So in this case, the parents probably had very high expectations. They wanted him to be the best, but again, he's not a human being in their eyes, even though they love him. They see him as an extension of their own ego, which is, again, it's a narcissistic fantasy that a lot of parents do with their kids. There's a quote I've used on here where it's, do you want to be a good parent or do you want to raise good kids? Because they're not the same thing. And if you don't understand what that means, ask your kids. They'll know. The idea is, it's very easy to parent when you're living vicariously through your children, because you're as hard on them as you would be on yourself without having that attack to your ego. You want your kids to basically be you. You yell at everybody who gets in their way. Anybody who doesn't rattle on about that narrative about how special her little boy is, or how he's the greatest guy in the world because he's me. He's everything that I wanted to do but couldn't. So when these kids grow up, they're messed. And all it takes is one manipulative woman and just ruins their life. In this case, same thing. So tell me about this. And here's the thing. Because the family wanted that perfect family of the grandkids and that, they were willing to tell the guy to go back to his woman who drove him absolutely miserable. I think even on the examples here, she like cheats on him, constantly berating him, a battle axe of a wife. And this is why it's important. So if you go on to it, Paul got very drunk and his smoldering anger and resentment built up over years by Connie's pussy whipping finally exploded into a drunken act. After 2 hours of her nagging him to stop drinking so much, he walked over to the bucket, picked up the anniversary cake his mother had baked for them, walked back to Connie, told her to go screw herself, and dropped the cake over her head. Paul then walked out of the party and drove to a motel for the night. When he sobered up, he came home and told Connie that he was sorry he ruined the party, but if she didn't stop nagging him in the future, he was going to belt her one right in the mouth. You can tell this is the 70s. That's a 70s thing to say. Don't do that. That's an ultimatum, because he's not going to do it. But to be fair, this isn't anger. This isn't frame. This is pure desperation on his part. This is him saying, I don't have the tools to get out of this. So the only thing I know how to do is give out this violent ultimatum. That's the only thing I have left. So a good benefit of adopting these skills, I mean, not to mention from a societal level, you're going to drop down, a lot less spousal abuse is happening because guys will have tools to deal with these things, to deal with conflict and manipulation. And we've always said there is no greater loss of frame than having to resort to violence. And this is a good example of why. So after a verbal fight that lasted several hours, Connie told Paul that he was mentally sick and he should get treatment. That part made me laugh. Like, picture this scenario. Let's look at it from the top down. You got a guy that's been helicopter parented his whole life to the point where he's a mushy sack of meat. His wife gets him. She's a battle axe. She berates him. She critiques him. She manipulates him. She basically makes her the center of his life, and he goes along with all of this. He's a weak shell of a man, afraid to assert himself, afraid to stand up for himself. He gets to the point where he's so desperate, and every person in his entire support network is pro-team woman and anti-team him, that he finally has his one desperate freak out. It's essentially a cry for help saying, I need you people to stop treating me like a piece of trash or I'm probably going to snap. And what's their answer? Oh, why is he so angry? What's wrong with him? Everybody else is happy. It's like, women don't get it. Men aren't happy. Speaking of which, here's another article for you. Archwinger. I always love talking about him. I actually put a copy of this one on my site before I did the thing there, because I like talking about it on a meta level. So I'll link to that one. The original one's on Reddit anyway, and we all hate Reddit. But it's men are not happy. And so when he describes it, every month or two, there's a post somewhere on Reddit by a woman saying something like, my boyfriend started doing red pill stuff, and now I want out, followed by 4 to 6 paragraphs explaining how her boyfriend is now a controlling, abusive ass who works out and wants sex because, you know, those traits are unique to the red pill. Any guy who exhibits them obviously went online, found us, and we ruined him. Anyways, these threads get seized on by every detractor, the ex-red pillers, the purple pillers, the blue pillers, who eagerly point out, see, it doesn't work. It just ends relationships and turns guys into douchebags. So independent of what is and is not red pill behavior, Sitchin's like these are based on a bad assumption. Simply put, the examples of this, the girl complaining that is angry that her man's changes assume that the relationship was already good and that he was not, and that he was actually happy and that it was ruined. But the thing they forget, and this begs the question, if this relationship was fine before the boyfriend went all red pill on his woman, why is he trying to change? Why, out of pure desperation, did he go on the internet and seek out the sphere, talk to a bunch of random assholes on the net who have, let's face it, we don't have the best reputation. People thinking we're basement-dwelling neckbeards for the most part. So why is he there? And that's because men aren't happy. They don't want to be sweet and sensitive and do things for women all day long and be the perfect boyfriend. Meanwhile, they get nothing out of it. While having subpar sex every 6 weeks, paying out the ass for expensive gifts and dates, sacrificing personal time, getting bitched at, threatened with a breakup if any of this perfect behavior ever dips so slightly. Sure, everything's hunky-dory with the girlfriends. Everything's hunky-dory with the parents, with the job. Everybody's happy but this guy, and nobody cares, even though they all love him. It's a good read. I would suggest give this one a read too. I don't want to get too off topic because it's a lot about it, but the key point here is realize nobody gives a shit about you. You ain't shit. And that's okay. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Your entire social network can be happy and you're not happy. And not only do people not care, irregardless of whether they love you or not, as soon as you start trying to assert yourself, they'll assume something's wrong with you because why are you rocking the boat? So he starts doing some of the same sessions dealing with the stuff we're talking about here. And after discussing why he wanted Connie to see him, and that was the thing, he asked if he could bring Connie in to see the therapist as well. It became apparent that Paul wanted me to be the referee for their interactions. I told Paul that I would see him and Connie together if she was willing to take part in the marital counseling, but experience had taught me that this would serve no therapeutic purpose for me to be a referee. Marriage counseling does not work, and that's why. I'm going to pull out all kinds of articles for you guys today. Marriage counseling, from a female perspective, usually she suggests it when she's already checked out of the relationship. And this is that final straw. Sometimes, for the process of divorce, you have to have seen marriage counseling, some way to establish to the courts that you've tried everything and it doesn't work. Girls that doing it out of pure desperation, they just treat the therapist like he's a referee. I need you to tell him that I'm right, he's wrong, and treat the therapist as the authority. Now, let me ask you this. Put a pin in this article, by the way, or coming back to it. Let me ask you this. Knowing what you know of about hypergamy, girl looking up to only one man at a time, being extremely loyal to that one man so long as he's the top option in her life, what benefit does it serve to create an authority out of a third party in your relationship, and how does that help the relationship get better? It's not a rhetorical question. The answer is it doesn't. Again, you're deferring hypergamy to a third party, and all that's doing is lowering yourself, even though on paper it sounds good. Well, we're talking about it. We got a professional here. He's good at this stuff. And unfortunately, that's not his role. His role is not to handle conflict and manage expectations and to be the oak and to be the referee. You are the only judge that matters, and you need to be the dominant person in this relationship. So you need to be the therapist. You need to be the referee. Your way or the highway goes. Set strong boundaries. Live up to strong boundaries. Be valuable enough that the other person is invested in adhering to those boundaries, and everything falls into place. And if it doesn't, well, it's better to learn that now as opposed to 12 years down the line when you're going to have a ton of alimony payments and you're pretty much willing to put a bullet in yourself for it. You know what I mean? Can't save everybody, but if she's got potential, you pulling your life around usually brings girls around. The only question is it too late for you to actually care about that when it does? but that's not my job to tell you. That's your job to know what you want to do. So Paul agreed on this one that his request was only for a manipulative attempt to get me to tell Connie that her behavior towards him was wrong, and he still thought the counseling was good for them and for both of them and a good idea. Good for you, Paul. To go into it again, how does it end? I think it ends here after they do another dialogue. They do love their dialogues. There we go. So when Paul and I later discussed his assertive interactions with his father, he was kind of going through this afterwards, it became apparent to me that Paul had accomplished much for himself in that one session. He still had, what seemed to me at least, a problem in relating to his father. Now, in this case, this could be the wife, this could be the father. They're all going to have the same kind of like relationship pathway to him. Here, one sec. The one predominant feeling in Paul's interaction evoked was a heavy sadness. The doctor was touched. I felt sad for Paul because the type of relationship he had with his father, and I also felt sad for his father, who possibly out of anxiety over a lot of things had used his son's life to cope with those anxieties. In being touched, I had committed the classic cardinal sin of the therapist, countertransference. I had personally identified too much with the patient problems. Worse yet, he told Paul about his feelings in the following dialogue, and he talks about it again. Again, a lot of the empathy that comes with psychologists or psychotherapists or whatever, the talk therapy, once they start empathizing with you, they're kind of doing bad therapy. Like, they're not supposed to empathize with you. They're supposed to help you work through these problems. They're supposed to be giving you these tools that I'm giving you now. And a lot of them don't. A lot of them just listen to your problems, say everything's okay and whatever. But it's going to be the process a lot of guys find. So in this case, there was a sadness with his dad. You're going to find... Actually, let's go Jordan Peterson here. Remember that belly of the whale thing? Jonah goes in the belly of the whale and saves his father. There's some truth to that. I actually have a post on my blog called Replacing Our Fathers. I think it's my old one. Yeah, it's on the old one. So whatever, read it if you want to. We're going to get to that chump lady one in a minute. But for the most part, you're going to have a situation with your parents. Like, my stepdad was the guy, you're not a man until you fight your old man. And so we kind of got into a fight when I was 18. He never liked me, but then he kind of got over it. And I kind of realized a lot of the stuff, that promise keeper stuff that Rollo Tomassi talks about, the mom is so angry because dad has a lot of unhealthy, non-assertive coping strategies. She will complain about you as the emotional tampon about your dad. And so you, because of those same reasons I talked about before, you're helpless. This is the most important person in your life and your safety is dependent on her taking care of you. So out of a fear of abandonment, you adopt this promise keeper attitude that I'm never going to be like that guy that hurt my mom's feelings because you're a kid and you don't know any better. So then you grow up, you have this eventual conflict and resolution with your father, if you had it, or your mother or your wife, whatever. And then you kind of learn, and this is part of the acceptance stage of the red pill. Like, you'll have your anger stage when you realize you've been screwed over your whole life. You get very angry, you get sad, you get depressed. The acceptance phase, you realize that, yeah, okay, so dad was forcing me to be this. He was the helicopter parent, but they were insecure about their life and very, very sad about opportunities they missed. Maybe some moms even go so far as to say that they were going to have a great life, but you as a kid, when she had gave birth to you, ruined it all. Pretty messed up thing to say to your kids, but it's very common. As you grow up, part of that and part of like red pilling and learning these tools is you kind of learn they did the best they had. They have certain faults and your parents' generation just didn't have the tools to deal with this stuff. Yeah, it's here in this book, but nobody read books back then. It was the 70s. They were too busy doing, you know, weed or whatever they do. I don't know what people did in the 70s, but they weren't doing this. And so you kind of understand, like, I get it. Guys kind of figured it out with the wives. Once they get past the anger phase and they become self-actualized and red-pilled, they realize, okay, she was acting like that because, like, I basically left a power vacuum. I kept submitting to her. And so she took up the reins of the leader of the family and she's horrible at it. She doesn't have the skills. They kind of treat it like a dog who got rabies. Even if you leave her, like, even if you have to put the dog down, it's like, it wasn't his fault. Did the best he could. He just got bit. Yeah, you're not happy about it. You just deal with it. So it's a neat thing that you're going to learn. And this is kind of, I don't see it often because this is advanced stuff. This isn't stuff you're going to see on a YouTube video about 7 ways to be more alpha. This is not going to be a YouTube video on how to win your girlfriend back. This is a guy who's been at it for like a couple years. He's kind of processed all his demons. He's attractive. He's less unattractive. For the most part, he's either got his family under control or he's remove the people in his life that he doesn't want there, so he has them in control. And they have this certain self-reflection and this certain coming to terms with like the fallibility of human beings. And it's a very rewarding thing when you see guys hit this, because you realize they really got it. They really got it. And they're, I would argue, until you're at that point, you're not really red-pilled. So it's my thought on that one. Another one here they're going to be talking about is learning to say no. And this is like from the female perspective. I kind of like it because, well, I'll let you know why when we talk about it here. Before I move on, though, that Chump Lady article I just put in there, it's a great article, especially when guys get cheated on or when there's conflict like this in a relationship. Do they actually feel bad about this conflict? And that's real remorse or genuine imitation Naga hide remorse. I also have a video on my channel. I think it's one of the omelet ones. Oh, no, a red-pilled coffee about I don't have time for your cheating whore and ways, I think it was called. But it's a little checklist. And I run through this back when I was still taking on clients, where it's a 6-point checklist. So yeah, she cheated on you and she feels really bad about it and she wants to make things work out. Well, let's run through the checklist. Does she actually feel bad? Because again, we lie to ourselves and that's how we can lie to others. So we want to believe that she's remorseful and we want to take her back and everything will be better. But you look through this, humility. Cheating's about entitlement. So does she actually have humility? And most of the time the guys will find, yeah, the girl ends up getting very dismissive and tells me to get over it. So like, that's not very humble. Like, that comes with the understanding that you've broken a sacred trust with somebody who's committed to you, and they have to heal on their terms, not yours. Second is initiative, and this is the one that's applicable here. Real remorse books their own appointments. They go to their own things. They aren't late. If you have to drag somebody kicking and screaming to the stuff that you need to have done to, you know, forgive them, well, then that lets you know right now they don't feel bad for doing it. They feel bad for getting caught. Third one is honesty. If you start getting trickle truth, right there, you know, they aren't having honesty. Because if, and this is common, when most time a guy will get cheated on or a guy gets berated and henpecked, it's always trickle truth. It's like, yeah, well, like, he's just a friend of mine. Well, I mean, he was at the thing, but we didn't do anything. Well, we made out a little bit, but we didn't sleep together. Well, we slept together, but it was just the one time. Well, we slept together a bunch, but it didn't mean anything. And then like, hey, it's really your baby. I swear to God, I just know. That little trickle truth tells you, again, you're not getting remorse. You're just getting somebody trying to get the bad feelings of breaking something go away. So once you start getting trickle truth, that tells you exactly what you need to know. Next one is patience. They have to understand that, yeah, they don't have the high ground for a long time. And so you may have moments where you're acting kind of petty about it, but, you know, patience on their end. You're having patience with them doing all the crap they did. And if they aren't showing some back, then why should you invest more than them? They're the one that broke the trust. Fifth one is ownership. And then again, that ties in with honesty. They wear the shame. One of the worst things, I think, when it comes to cheating, you'll hear is, well, don't tell my family or don't tell my friends. Asking you to hide the lie. That's not an ownership thing. An ownership thing is them being honest about it and accepting the consequences. And this is why most girls hate accepting responsibility. So this is why most of the time, once this is done, there's really no point to it. But the last one is recompense. You get to call the terms. What is it I have to do to win back your heart? If they don't want to do it, then that lets you know what you got to do. You're setting terms. And you should be anyways, but now it's just kind of obvious. I have yet to see a guy who's been cheated on, who's been battle-axe-wifed, who's been berated for years, who's in that point of desperation where they're willing to talk to some random asshole on the internet. I have never seen a guy get through that checklist and say, yeah, they're doing all this stuff. They really do want forgiveness. Never. It's always been, now that you mention it, she didn't do any of this stuff. Yeah, she doesn't really care, does she? I'm like, yeah, welcome to the anger phase, bro. Back to the topic, though. So this is about girls putting out in relationships, and this is the part that's going to kind of differ substantially from a red-pilled lens. So in clinically working with women of all ages and circumstances, single, divorced, widowed, I have observed that such structured beliefs and the new sexual expectations are used by some as an excuse for not getting involved in other meaningful activities. Activities which must produce growth and change them into more interesting to new men other than just on a sexual basis. Forming a relationship primarily on the basis of sexual intercourse is a cheap shot and quite easy to do. The only difficult is that such a relationship doesn't last long, at least for the women, and men too, whom I see clinically. The problem for many of them is they want an instant, close relationship and don't want to have to go through the doubt, uncertainty, hard work of the slow and sometimes painful building of such a close relationship. This is why it's dated, because this is the norm now. This is normalized to a level that's unheard of, that they would not have thought about in the 70s. Yeah, this instant connection, quick sex thing, that's the norm. And it's been devalued in such a level over the past 50 years that without sex, there is no relationship. Like, sex really doesn't mean anything. Getting a phone number means nothing now. You'll still get ghosted. Just kissing a girl, ghosted. Anything short of actually going to Pound Town is not going to get you what you need to get. So while every time I see a lot of the trad dudes talking about, I want something more meaningful, I want something better than sex, higher than sex, just realize they're talking about stuff that's 50 years too old. They might as well talk about taking the girl to the ballroom dance or whatever else they did in the 40s. Take her to the malt shoppy for a milkshake. It's like, dude, way too early for that. You might as well just take up leeching if you're going to talk about this old stuff. They do another dialogue. I won't go into it, but in their interaction, Dana communicated her problem to John and supported her attempt to cope with her own mixed feelings about their relationship. I'll give you a hint. He played at her. If, on the other hand, John was not John, but somebody else less mature and less sure of his open personal machismo or sexual masculinity, he might have ignored Dana's request for an exploration of their relationship based on things besides sex, common interests, intellect, personality styles, long-term goals, likes, and dislikes. If he was less sure of his ability to attract women sexually, John may have wanted to try to verbally manipulate or seduce, I find that a very clever choice of words, and titillate Diana or Dana into bedding down again in spite of her mixed feelings about it. You could argue he's talking about last-minute resistance on this, which, the way it was done here, too much talking. I guess I'll address that one quickly. So last-minute resistance is when a girl has her anti-slut defense, so she starts feeling like, I'm not a slut, I'm not just here to get laid, and she kind of puts the brakes on the romantic interaction. Most guys kind of get pushy, sets the whole thing south, everybody goes home, blue balls all around. In general, what you do is they sell something called a freeze-out. You're like, okay, if you don't want to have sex, that's fine. Like, it's yes means yes. We're that culture now, and I'm fine with that. That's probably a pretty noble way of doing things. So yeah, okay, fine. No sex on the table, and then you pull validation, because that's what matters for you. You want sex, she wants validation. It's like an instant trade. So you don't give one without getting the other. That's how we establish a good boundary. So you do what's called a freeze out. You go, start doing something else. Pick it up later. If it still doesn't work, all right, check you out later. This almost never comes up, by the way. By the time you get this far into the interaction, you have to screw up pretty bad to get the brakes put on you, especially nowadays. But that's what he's referring to there. He calls it manipulation, and it is, but everything is manipulation, so I wouldn't stress about it too much. As far as the personal machismo thing in the talk, here is the issue. This girl is having the talk, and I'm going to post. This is going to be a good thing. It's actually from a whisper. Oh, for crying out loud. All right, it turns out there's too many articles on that one. Essentially, it's the talk is ridiculous. Whichever choice of words there. Don't do it. And it's the idea that women talk with subtext. Women infer. Women subtextually talk about. Women don't overtly talk. When a woman is being overt, that's her version of an ultimatum. She has no idea how to communicate other than to be direct. And you know that's a huge jump for women because that tacks into that possible rejection. So it's a very sensitive place for a girl to be. Having said that, we know ultimatums are the ultimate expression of powerlessness. So if you get at a point where a girl has that where are we talk, like the I want a relationship, but I don't know how to encourage you to do it with my normal tools, it's not going to work because it establishes that the guy has the power in the situation. The girl is desperate and it just rubs the wrong way. And for the most part, if you have to ask, you kind of know the answer. In this case, John didn't want a relationship. He was open about it. Like, maybe I'll open to it. I don't know. But right now, I like what we have right now. And that's the thing. From a guy's perspective, those are your boundaries. This is just a sexual relationship for me. A girl can latch on to a guy for years thinking that change his mind, but that's not your problem. You're very upfront and clear with your intentions. In fact, a good way to articulate this is, do you know that saying from Rational Male where girls would rather share an alpha than be saddled with a beta? Or share a top-tier man rather than be saddled with it? A lot of guys think that's ridiculous. That's stupid. No girl would ever put up with that. My girl would never do that. Well, picture the scenario of a guy who's got a wife at home and he's got a mistress. And that mistress is sticking around for years because he says, yeah, I'll leave my wife for you, you know, soon. I just got to finish this or I got to finish that. That right there is a perfect example that everybody has some experience with. A mistress is that sharing an alpha. So once you start getting that talk, it's not effective. Girls need to understand. Now, there's other girl strategies and they don't work. And I'm not the best at this and it's very off topic for the channel. So I'll just touch on it briefly. The idea of women using sex to get a relationship, it doesn't work. Because sex is such a low value commodity nowadays that anybody can give it away. I can get it from anybody. What do you offer? So they essentially have to do non-sexual things. They have to essentially lead from the relationship standpoint. Because while girls do control the sexual market, guys ultimately control the relationship market. Commitment is our currency. And this is where girls have to start doing things. So by the time you get to the point where you want to talk about your feelings and what you expect out of a relationship, you should have been spending that time, you know, doing the things that feminists hate having guys say they enjoy. The cooking for him thing, the cleaning his house when he's out thing. In fact, that's, if you know your girl wants a relationship, the one telltale sign you have is that when you're sleeping in after you've had her over, she cleans your house for you. Soon as she cleans your house, you know she wants to keep you, leaving stuff at your place. But that's the point. Non-sexual things that you find valuable. Not things that she thinks you'll find valuable, things that you find valuable. Putting efforts into gifts. All that beta behavior you're thinking of, girls doing that show that they're open for a relationship. And you catch the signal and you either don't say no and just let things happen, or you cut it off. Which is kind of funny when you think about it, because when it comes to sex, girls have a bunch of decision points and all they have to do is not make a decision and let things happen and things will flow into sex. It's the same with relationships. Girls invest in the relationship and a guy doesn't kick her to the curb. It's the decision is non-decision, which is kind of interesting because most of our stuff is based on acting the way you want. But in this case, it's one of those exceptions. It's actually something one of the moderators and I talked about, Yui McGill. It was, guys were asking, how did you know to upgrade your girl? And I came up with the story, like, I never really dated her. We never had the talk. We were just dating. And I was looking for an excuse to dump her. And after like 12 months, she never gave me one. She was nothing but the greatest girl ever. And then UEM chimed in, the same thing, man. I was out there slamming girls left and right. This one, just like for a straight year, was just great. And never did anything to cross any of my boundaries. And just kind of nestled into a relationship after that, which is kind of the way it has to work. That's why you have to wait, because they can keep on a good girl persona for a while. They can act like the good girlfriend, but if it's just a mask, if they're not invested and they have an ulterior motive based on anxiety or whatever, or self-interest, they can't keep it up for long. After about a year, you're going to see who the girl is. And if you are the hypergamous best option, well, by the 12th month, you're going to see it. So in this case, his advice to women, absolutely horrible. The assertive stuff is good, but applying it to intimate relationships for them is horrible. And like I said, back to my tamago sandwich video, women are lied to their entire lives. And this, even a well-intentioned book, giving girls the absolute worst advice they could give. And here, he even admits at the end it didn't work. So although this demonstration was carried to the worst possible extreme for any future dating relationship, you can see that if possible male sexual partner had listened to his date's assertive but empathic no earlier in the piece, he might have been in a position to date her again and if she had changed her mind. Essentially, he just nuked the thing. Like, if you're going to be like this, I'm out. Or he pissed her off and said that she was being a tease and she kicked him out. But that's the point. You make this stuff an ultimatum and it's going to blow up in your face. Like, guys will call this bluff. It's just one of those interesting things. Now, skipping past, they got another assertive thing on how you can handle it a bit better. Get into another one with this guy, Ted. So Ted was more manipulative than the dialogue shows. Again, same situation. The interaction took place over several weeks, but it took worked out the compromise of living together to see how compatible Beth and Ted really were. As it turns out, Beth's doubts about Ted as a long-term partner were proved true. Yeah, he just wanted a plate. After 6 months of living together, they both decided to separate, go their own ways. As you might have guessed from Ted's responses in the dialogue, the separation was amicable. Actually, that's a pretty good one, too, when you look through it, because I can bet... You know what? Read through this one. If you read through all of them, what is this? Dialogue number 28? Where's the number? Anyways, that's on page 271. But it's good. This is the guy who's so conflict-averse that he was actually trying to have her move in. Again, iron rule of Tomasi. Don't move in if you're not planning on settling down with the girl in 6 months. But, oh, here we go. Here was the juicy stuff that I was trying to find. So what could have been a very messy, emotional, and legal situation was avoided at the start by Beth listening to her own inner feelings and thoughts and assertively acting upon them. Part of these feelings were doubts based on Ted's hidden agenda for proposing marriage. Being married to Beth was supposed to give him the right to make her stop flirting with other men. Beth's flirting behavior was a behavior which activated Ted's self-doubts about his own sexual attractiveness to women and his ability to keep Beth sexually interested in himself. That's the one that resonates. So many guys want to create these Calvin ball rules. Well, once we're married, you're not allowed to flirt with other guys. You're not allowed to flirt. You can't do this. We're in a relationship. You can't do this. All these guys telling these rules as to why a girl can't be hypergamous outside of the relationship. And it's not how it works. Again, that's always a deep-seated insecurity about your status in the relationship or your abundance mentality. His goal here, instead of actually being assertive, was just to propose marriage, to build up additional rules, and it blows up in your face every time. So in general, I don't really care about Beth's behavior, because Beth's a big tease and she's going to do what she does. Ted's behavior would just be very simple. She wants to have a girls' night out, or she wants to go flirt with dudes. Like, yeah, I don't date girls that do that kind of stuff. And that's it. You're not saying it angry. You're not saying it stoically. You're just saying it. It's like a law of the universe. The same way you're talking about how gravity works on that apple in your hand. I don't hate girls who pull that thoughtery out. And then she makes the choice. She does it because, whatever, you're just insecure and doesn't do it. Or she doesn't do it because she sees you as her best option, and losing you would terrify her. And that slight insecurity actually is what drives Dread Game along and builds you up as a hypergamous best option. It's a very mild form of something called hysteric bonding, which I'll touch on in a minute. But yeah. You set these boundaries off as what you will and will not put up with. And right there, you have your answer. Is she hypergamous? Always. Are you the best option? Well, that'll let you know the next time she goes to take a girl's night out, because you can't control her or tell her what to do. And how you act on that matters so much more than what these guys did, which was 6 months of living together in hell, just to realize I probably should have said something the first time you started thirst trapping people online. So that's it for this book. It's really great. That's chapter 10. Never mind. Really close equal late relationship, sex and assertion. Again, a lot of this stuff is going to tie into that relationship equity thing, and communication is always good. It's the part that kind of bothers me about the book, and the part that's least applicable, is because he spends the entire first 9 chapters talking about how to properly set boundaries, how to be assertive. And then as soon as he gets to a girl in the mix, it's open communication, doing your own things and paying lip service. But the one thing that's good to take out of it, and I'll tell you why in a second, there's 3 basic treatment models for sexual problems, and the therapists most associated with their use are the anxiety model, and that's Dr. Joseph Wolpe, Dr. Zev, and the anger model, and a mixed model. So in plain language, the anxiety model says you aren't built to enjoy yourself sexually and worry about things like your income tax return at the same time. If you're going to see people talking about avoidant behavior, this is going to be talking about the anxiety model. I consider it to be absolute crap, complete pseudoscience nonsense. The idea of chore play, of if you did more chores around the house, I'd be more comfortable, less anxiety, and we would have sex. That's how that falls under this. It's ridiculous because anxiety is the best aphrodisiac. Dread Game is built upon the fear of loss, rekindling any feelings that were in a relationship. Like, you're already checked out. But from the female perspective, that's usually what happens. And that's why they consider it super manipulative, because you're just trying to make me feel anxious, so I'll want to get back together with you. You're like, no, you're going to feel anxious because I've checked out and I'm going to replace you, and you don't want to lose a good man. But again, that's built in the anxiety model, saying you shouldn't do that and relationships are healthier when you don't. And I can just tell you from hundreds of examples that that's absolute crap. It does not work that way. Like, unfortunately, anxiety is just built into the system. Anxiety is an aphrodisiac, and you just have to accept it. From a guy's standpoint, it works, though. Like, you can't be anxious about things. And he goes into erectile dysfunction, all kinds of stuff there. I would argue that the one example that's good to relieve anxiety from a female perspective, is religious indoctrination. A lot of those super hardcore sects of Christianity or Islam and that have that sex equals bad drilled into a girl's head, which can make her very, very prudish to an extreme degree. Now, I would argue, don't even get into a relationship with that girl. And that's why I hate the guys who want their virginal good girl wife, because if you find one in this day and age, chances are that somebody's gaslit her brain and just ruined her for everybody. So yeah, she won't cheat on you, but she won't sleep with you either. So congratulations. If you can't have her, nobody will. Or if nobody can't have her, neither will you. Again, that's a whole topic on its own, so we're just going to go on that. So during this time, the typical patient anticipated further failure, and in being sensitive to the slightest sign of failure during the next sexual act induced further anxiety to him or herself, thereby producing the complete failure he or she was looking for, a self-fulfilling prophecy. In the cases where their sexual partners were quite unsympathetic with such failure and put pressure on them to perform, the patient's own worries made initial anxiety even more intense and guaranteed failure. Two things there. One, the feedback loop of anxiety. I've talked about it a lot. When you get anxiety in any situation, whether it's sexual like this or just generally in life, the one thing that people will do is as they feel anxiety, they feel bad, they go, "What's wrong with me? Why am I feeling bad right here?" And then the anxiety amplifies because you're no longer anxious about you in this sexual situation or you like having nervousness about approaching. Now there's something wrong with you as a person. And so your 2 out of 10 panic turned into a 10 out of 10 panic attack. As soon as you normalize this, like I said, my parents messed up raising me. I haven't seen a guy since I was 18. Of course, I'm going to be anxious around talking to girls. I've never done this before. I've never been good at it. And I have fears of rejection. That's what you're supposed to feel like. Once you normalize it, you're like, okay, now that I know I'm supposed to feel anxious, I can go do it anyway and tap into that. Pretend that this feeling is a good feeling, like working out and feeling muscle soreness. The second part of it is about talking about your insecurities and your feelings. So we talked about that yesterday with the Jack Ten of Heart stuff, so I won't go into that too much other than to say she doesn't care. She's just mad you're not performing. Girls take sexual rejection horribly, and because it can't be her fault, it has to be yours. And this is why guys who talk about their inadequacies to women usually get berated for it because they don't want to hear it. So yeah, don't do either of those things. That's about as good a set of information as you get from the anxiety model. So unlike the anxiety model with all of its diagnostic clues indicating a psychological inability to have sexual relations, sometimes with a very rapid onset, the anger model has only one clear indication that a sexual difficulty exists. A gradual decrease in the frequency of sex with a spouse over a long period of time, perhaps months, maybe years. Although sexual frequency in couples is a sexual problem described by the anger model, often reaches zero for significant periods of time, frequency invariably bounces back and forth between periods of no sex and periods of low frequency sex. During these periods of low frequency intercourse, none of the sexual types of difficulties described in the anxiety model is observed. The male patients have no significant problems with anything physical. And the anger model assumes, like the anxiety model, that the low frequency is a result of problems besides things in the bedroom. Typically, one of the partners may hold hidden grudges against the other. He or she has a lot of unexpressed anger, and the anger may be denied. The fact that it's a sexual problem even exists may be denied. Dude, Karen is a perfect example of the anger model. Sexually frustrated housewives taking their anger out on the world by wanting to see the manager. It's not just them, though. Guys, too. Put a guy in the red pill, get him into his anger phase, start building some value out of himself, and you'll get something called the 1,000-foot toe rope. The 1,000-foot toe rope is the understanding that even though you're improving yourself and removing all your unattractive behaviors, your partner takes a long time to get caught up. They're still caught in seeing you as the waste of space. And so it's like a 1,000-foot toe rope. You pull. It's going to take a long time before it gets taught. We usually say a good 6 months. And when you see your girl over that 6 month period, you don't actually see her and you're not angry at her, but you're harboring a hidden grudge towards yourself. How did I let things get this bad? But your ego prevents you from blaming yourself for it. So you dump all that guilt onto her. And that's why that anger phase, I hate my wife stuff comes up. Again, it passes because after that 6 months is over, the tow rope goes tight and either she pulls away or she starts getting into in line. Either way, your go plan is the same as the stay plan, and everything works out. A lot of time, too, what guys end up doing is they want to teach their girl a lesson. So if your goal in a relationship is more sexual frequency and better enthusiasm, none of that duty sex, no starfish sex, that's one thing. But what happens is guys start improving themselves, and then the girl starts throwing themselves at her, or throwing herself at him a bit more. But what he does is, because he wants to teach her what it's like to get shot down, he starts rejecting her. And that's like an ego defense from the anger model right there. And most guys end up ripping the guy a new one. It's like, dude, the sexual strategy here is never turn your girl down, ever. Well, why is that? Well, she's been so mean all these years. It's like, dude, your goal is to set a boundary here. And your boundary is that as a couple, like, this is the narrative. As a couple, we don't turn each other down. We don't say no. And how is she supposed to follow your lead if you're not leading that? So suck it up, buttercup. Even if you're in your refractory period, sometimes you got to just bite the bullet and go to town. You know what I mean? But yeah, these hidden grudges and this hidden anger can manifest in so many different ways. You're never going to be fully actualized or red-pilled or an integrated man until you deal with these anger issues on the side. And again, once you realize that you're not angry at the other person, but you're angry at yourself for what you're willing to put up with for so long, and you see your failures on other people's behavior, until you're past that, you're never going to end up getting into a good relationship or even good plates. Plates actually have it worse, because those tend to be more extreme examples of what I'm talking about here. But I won't get into that, because we're not going to talk about struggle hugging or any of that crap. And the mixed model of treatment for sexual dysfunction assumes that both anxiety and anger components are involved in the history of the problem. It's the one we kind of most relate with. But it's good. So you can read on this. He talks about kinks. He has some dialogues. I would ignore the dialogues. Oh, the one I said before was dialogue 30, because this one's 31. But this dialogue here is tells his wife that the sex is routine and he seeks some change. Dude, don't talk. Talking will dry her out faster than anything. Just throw sand in her vagina while you're at it. Don't even bother. If you want things kinkier, act kinkier. Ragdoll your girl a little bit. Make some experiments. You can usually, like, you're already at the point where you're doing OODA loops. Observe, orient, decide, act. You're repeating these as fast as possible so you can get into a better place faster. Sexually, it's the same thing. Try some kink. If you don't know how to kink, like, for an example, some people are into choking. If you don't know how to do choking, the easiest thing to do is just take your hand, place it on a girl's clavicle like this, and just hold it there as if you're trying to keep her from sitting up. It's a very mild thing, and you test. You observe, you orient, you decide, you act. Okay, then you look. Is it the kind of thing that's turning her on? Is this working? You orient. Okay, so I'll try and escalate it and do something more kinky. You decide to do it, or maybe you keep it there, and then you act, and you keep going through this, and you will automatically. There's a term like building your own personal slut. But this stuff comes with practice, and you can't talk about it. Women don't want to talk about it. Just trust them. Look in their eyes. Listen to their sounds, watch what their hands are doing, see how much enthusiasm they get, and you'll do far better than talking your way through it. Do you like it like that? Do you like this? Do you think 3 degrees more to the left will work? She's like, get off me. I'm going to watch Oprah. I'm done. I'd rather pet the dog. And this practice dialogue is only one of real life situation learners have dealt with by being assertive with their mates and working out sexual compromises they can both feel better about. These compromises are as simple as sharing a sexual position preference within one act of intercourse or alternating them on different occasions. The one thing I will say here is verbal reinforcement is your friend. If she does something and she's trying new things because she sees you trying new things and it's something you like, well, afterwards, praise. Praise, praise, praise. Oh, what was that thing you did there? That was awesome. I loved that. Or maybe play up a little bit of play acting when she's doing it in the bedroom. Maybe you start moaning. Maybe you grunt like a caveman. Whatever it is you guys do. This is a Christian channel, so I'm not going to talk about it here. But verbal and nonverbal praise you can give is a great way to encourage good behavior. And just don't do it if you want to discourage bad behavior. He talks later on in the next dialogues. He has women learners practice assertively coping with the sexual difficulty often reported in clinical settings. An act of love without much loving. Although this behavior could be an expression of complete indifference of the husband towards his mate or ignorance of what her wants, the quick start habit is also a frequent pattern of secret behavior where male patients are clinically treated for difficulty in maintaining physical stamina over extended period of time. it's a whole female thing. It's good to read over the wham bam thank you man stuff. Like, they want to be wooed, they want foreplay. It's, if I have to tell you to do foreplay at this point, then I don't know what to tell you. And he kind of admits here, it takes several weeks to several months of doing this, being non-critical, non-defensive. Basically all the things we say about don't be secure, be attractive, don't be unattractive, and then just be patient. Some more dialogues. Again, read those if you want. And that, for the most part, is the end of When I Say No, I Feel Guilty. I hope you guys enjoyed it, hanging on this long. It's a bit of a slog. It's a lot of a denser read than No More Mr. Nice Guy, but I would argue for most people, you're probably, like, once you've developed the No More Mr. Nice Guy behaviors that you need to stop being a nice guy, this is a force amplifier like you've never heard of. Again, take from it the very simple tools. Broken record, fogging, negative inquiries, negative assertions. On top of that, good boundary enforcement. Realize communication doesn't work, and just applying these wholesale. You'll improve your love life. You'll improve your relationships. You'll improve your work life. The only other thing to take of it is you actually become better able to compartmentalize your relationships, like your boss and you versus the cops and you versus your wife and you versus everybody and you. And you're going to stop treating informal relationships as if they were formalized one with random rules, because you've shed your insecurity and you're perfectly happy saying no. Like I said, the girls' night out one. Well, I don't date girls that go out with their slutty girlfriends to go pick up dudes. Right there, that's a perfect assertion of your own boundary. It's, I don't like it. There's no reason for it. That's not what good girlfriends do. You're not going to act like a crappy single mom with your girlfriend. There's no, don't do that. It'll make you a whore or a hooker or a thought or a whatever. It's none of that. It's just, I don't like it and I don't put up with it. Do what you like. And right there, it puts the onus on the other person. And that's what we talk about with abundance. Like, there's an abundant mentality behind that to know you can go out and do this stuff. I'll replace you after I bounce your shoes off your ass on the way out the door. But you're not angry about it. You're not insecure about it. It's not an ultimatum. You're just letting them know, hey, gravity works, and so does me not simping for you. That's all there has to be. And you know what? You're going to have a cool, collected, more strategic level of alpha behaviors in your life that's not going to make you sound like one of these online brands that manned better than any man has ever manned before in the masculine mannery of the man. You know what I mean? None of that crap. So thank you for tuning in this much. Gonna start a new series. Again, it's a tie between Esther Villa's Manipulated Man and James Franco's Practical Female Psychology. I'm probably gonna put a couple one-offs in between there. Just stay tuned. Smash like. Hit subscribe. Oh yeah, hit like if you like the channel first off. If I've been delivering you guys good content, please do. It really helps support the channel, and these little pings of engagement allow us to reach more people. And let's face it, these thumbnails aren't full of like thoughts doing weird stuff. It's not the most clickbaity topics, but it's very important. So the better engagement we get, the more people who may not know they need this can actually find it and end up in a great actual sexual relationship and life. On that note, I'm going to put the links to all the articles I talked about in the description, and I will catch you guys tomorrow. Oh, before I forget, don't forget Patreon on Friday. We're doing the Q&As. Check it out. Link to that's in the description. See if you like it. It's a lot like this stuff, but it's more personalized and way less of a filter. And in the mornings between 9 and 10, I do streams on Twitch. We talk about this stuff. It's more like a scrapbook. We answer questions. We just ping ideas off each other. It's a very casual environment. If you like this stuff, but you don't feel like being preached at, that might be more up your alley. I will catch you guys on the next one, though. I like seeing you guys in the chat. Marty, I'm looking. I don't see a single sincere comment out of you, but they're all pretty funny. Logic behind bars with yours, biding your time, doing your due diligence. That's true. Like I said, you're not doing this for her. You're doing this to build these skills you need to be more attractive. And if that's what you have to do, then that's what you have to do. Have her as your sparring partner. Anyways, cheers, fellas.